Blog Talk Radio.
To an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Doing real good.
I'm really stoked about our show tonight. The more I look at the topic that we've put together here, how to worry wisely and what not to worry about, it occurred to me just as the music started playing that I forgot to put anything on the list about what not to worry about. So.
Well, what we're not asking the audience to do is to not worry at all, right? I mean,
that's right. That's right.
There are things to be concerned about. But we'll
test this, but I think we'll learn that if you worry wisely, then you won't worry about things that you shouldn't. However, off the top of my head, I'm going to throw a few out, okay, that I don't think you need to worry about. I mean, I don't know who you are, what your circumstances are, but just a few things that have just occurred to me as we've been talking about this, okay? I don't think you need to worry that Bigfoot is going to harm you in any way, right?
I think people cannot worry about that.
By and large, I don't think you have to worry about alien invasion. Yeah. What was yours?
Ancient astronauts. We don't need to worry about. I don't think
you have to worry that they're gonna do anything. Let me see. Shadow people. Have you heard of shadow people? I don't think you have to worry about the shadow people either. I'm going to say those three. If you're spending a lot of time worrying about them, you can stop. Okay. Just don't listen to that show that comes on the radio late at night and focus on some other stuff.
If you're your daughter, you don't need to worry about losing that front tooth anymore.
That's right. The tooth is out. Exactly. We were doing tooth watch. It's funny because you know she's had teeth come out before, and she had two out right before Christmas. Right, the blower two were out, and this one is just so prominent. You know, it looks like like a hockey player or something.
Is there anything cuter than a 5-year-old or 6-year-old with that front tooth missing? I mean, it's the height of cute.
Absolutely the height of cute. Then we had the tooth fairy come, and, you know, around here, she does a whole production, I'm telling you, with pixie dust. And, you know,
awesome.
It's like, well, she's really upped her game since I was a kid. That's all I can tell you. Because when I was a kid, it was like a coin under your pillow, okay? Yeah. And, she's come along. She's come a long way. Service has improved drastically.
When I was a kid, it was typically I'd pull the pillow back and there'd be nothing there. And I go, Mom, the tooth is still under my pillow. And she, yeah. Here, the tooth fairy left your coin in my wallet. You know, we'll make sure to mail her that tooth later.
Oh, that's awesome. And you bought that, right? You were like, oh, okay, that makes perfect sense. Sure.
Until I was 18 or 19, I was
fine. Then you start getting suspicious. Wait a minute.
Yeah, well, hold on.
Why would she put it in your wallet? Yeah, exactly.
Hmm.
I think you took it and put it in your wallet. I think I'm only getting part of what she left. Once you start thinking rationally about these things.
It comes together.
So, and that's another thing. I don't think people need to worry about too much about the tooth fairy. I would not spend too much worry.
Yeah, other things not for you.
But there are things that bear giving some serious thought to. And we talk about that, you know, we're more on the don't worry, be happy side of things on this show. We like to keep it positive, and we talk about all the good stuff that can happen. But we do make the point that a certain amount of our focus, a certain amount of our attention, and our effort has to be directed at preventing the bad things from happening. So we do have to think about the bad things that can happen. And we're going to talk about one to kick us off, and then the rest of our topics may or may not have anything to do with whether we should be worried. But we took the title from, actually it was from your response, Stephen, to this piece in The Economist, really interesting piece on computers called The Dawn of Artificial Intelligence. And one thing I made note of in the show notes over on Blog Talk Radio is how interesting it is that we're reading things like this in The Economist these days. This is a very well thought out piece, I think, talking about the potential risks of artificial intelligence, talking about it in a very serious way, talking about it as a serious scenario that we may well face in the very near future. And, I mean, is there a more mainstream publication in the world than The Economist?
If The Economist is spending some time on it, then it's filtered down to pretty much all the smart guys at this point. And there's a reason for that. When you've got people, and we're not talking Luddites, okay, that are worried about AI. When you got Elon Musk, which is, you know, some people have said he's the real life Iron Man, right? I mean, he's if there's anyone who is not a Luddite, it would be Elon Musk. And you got Stephen Hawking, and you got Bill Gates, all urging caution with AI. And I think Elon Musk is the one that said, we could be releasing the demon here. You know, this is the sort of thing we have to be really, really careful about getting right the first time. And we've spent a lot of time on this show and the predecessor show, Phil, saying pretty much the same thing. This is friendly AI is an important thing to get right. And, how do you worry about it? What's the right way to worry about this? And what are some things we probably shouldn't worry about? I would say first and foremost, maybe we shouldn't worry about.
Let's throw some things out there. Should we worry about Terminator style scenario, right? Should we worry that they're going to, that they're going to take over enough of the war machinery, enough of the manufacturing infrastructure, that we actually end up somehow at war with artificial intelligence? Is that a thing we should worry about, do you think?
I think we should spend some time considering this. And there's some things that we can do to mitigate that risk. Like leaving people in the loop. I think that's something we will do more and more. I mean, when we invent a new way to go about, warfare, we try things out, and then we pull back when we realize, hey, this is not the right way, this is not the ethical way to wage war. And, that's what was done with, in germ warfare after World War I. And since World War II, fortunately, nuclear weapons have not been used in warfare, except for the two instances in World War II. At the end of World War II, that's it. And
right.
The world is very fortunate about that. So I mean, pretty much, when it comes to using biological weapons, only outlaws use it. Apparently the Syrians did it recently. And that's about, that's about it in modern times, in the last
right.
10, 15 years. And that's great. And so there's some things we don't do. So what do we do with AI? Maybe AI powers our drones and suggests targets, but when it comes time to pull the trigger, we leave a human in that loop. And there's some things that we can do to avoid maybe the Terminator scenario.
Okay. So
what do you think, Bill?
I'm kind of wondering. I throw the question out there, I start to think about. Well, you think about all the nightmare AI scenarios. Which are the ones that we should take seriously, and that are serious threats? I think that we're probably a ways off from a Skynet type scenario. But what you suggest, the idea that there would always have to be humans in the loop, that Skynet would never be able to complete its function, right, without people stepping in, would actually prevent that, wouldn't it? The problem with Skynet in Terminator movies is it's got all the power, and it's making its own decisions. Now, the real risk is, well, there's two, right? There's two real risks with artificial intelligence that takes off on its own, that becomes its own, starts following its own purposes. And one is that it's deliberately trying to harm us. And the other is that it's just trying to do something because it's decided that that's what it wants to do, and it's indifferent to us, right? And it's just going to pursue those aims.
The paperclip scenario, right?
The old paperclip making scenario. It's just going to reduce the Earth to a pile of paperclips because, by golly, it likes paperclips and it doesn't care much about people. And that sort of thing is harder to avoid because, probably the line between, this is just a benign program that we've created to make paperclips. You know what I'm saying? You don't have that bright line around violence that you do with the military applications. You look at that when you go, okay, well, yeah, we let them be involved in a subordinate way. We let them be involved in a collaborative way, but we never put them fully in charge of it. But there's a lot of activities that are related to safety or related to just making stuff that we don't think of as necessarily granting power to harm, but ultimately could be, right, in the wrong hands, if controlled by a mind that is just, 180 degrees away from ours, that's just doing its own thing in its own time. Those become potentially pretty scary too.
Yeah, agreed. I'm changing the subject quite a bit here, but I would say that things that we shouldn't worry about, one of the things that we shouldn't worry about is that, whether or not we're going to have AI. That's a done deal, I would say, Bill. You mentioned The Economist, when the mainstream has accepted it, it's on the way. So the question is not whether we get AI, it's in what way we utilize it, and I would put it this way. Let me ask you, Phil, in your day job, do you feel that you collaborate in any meaningful way with machines? And I'm not talking, an AI necessarily. I mean, just, some sort of network or some sort of, even a file management system of some sort.
Oh yeah, I mean, I don't collaborate with machines. I collaborate with people using machines, right? If that's what you're asking, then definitely.
Yeah.
I was just having a conversation with one of my clients today, saying, "You got to get on Gmail so that we can share documents because you're forcing me to email you Word documents, and I just feel like I've been sent back in time or something like. Everybody else is on, Google Docs, and then." Because the beauty is, right, then there's only one document ever, right? It's like we're all creating this one document together. And, of course, Stephen, you and I practically invented Google Docs, if you'll recall.
back when it was called Writely.
Yeah, I mean, my Google experience goes all the way back to Writely, and I've still got Writely documents in my Google Docs, so I'm pretty proud of that. But simple stuff like that, Skype, Dropbox, Google Docs, that technology has enabled a whole level of collaboration that was very difficult to do in the past. I mean, it was really hard for a group of people scattered out in different places to create a single document, or even people in one office to create a single
document. I was about to say, Phil, I could be sitting next to somebody, you know, 20 years ago and not be able to collaborate with them as well as I can collaborate with you halfway across the country today. I would suggest that if you are in a job that you are not, you know, using, you know, machines to collaborate with others, or, you know, or in my particular case, I'm using a law office management program that, I mean, you know, it's beyond just just a place to dump documents and keep the documents in order. It's it keeps bringing things around that need to be done, and it keeps my entire staff on track, including myself. They kid about feeling like they're on a treadmill, but it's amazing what we accomplish now, because there's nothing, you know, just sitting there doing, it used to be you sort of would move from fire to fire, putting out fires, but that's not the way. You are much more proactive when you're collaborating with a machine that just keeps things moving. And I would say, if you want to worry properly, worry if you're not learning how to use tools like that, because that is the way the world is going, and you need to get on board with that, whatever your job is, and get out in front of that, because you will be invaluable to what you will become, what employers are beginning to look for, if you are conversant and know how to use these new tools. And
I think when you talk about tools, you know, to swing it back around to AI, that, it feels to me, is the direction that the author of the piece in The Economist is taking it. Right now, AI as it exists is a tool. It's a technology. And it is a technology that not only enables us to work collaboratively with each other in new ways, but it is a technology that we can collaborate with. One of the examples given in there is Garry Kasparov talks about how the best chess players in the world today now aren't people or computers. It's a human and a computer working together. He calls it a centaur, right? So you put a human and a computer together, and they're unbeatable, right? Because
I would say
they've got the whole thing covered.
Centaur. Yeah, I think every job in the information age, at least for the next few years until we're totally eclipsed by computers, the best teams will be centaurs.
No, I was just gonna say, and as long as it's that, there's nothing to worry about. If it's a tool you're using, or a tool that people are using, that's not a thing to worry about. So if you want to worry wisely about artificial intelligence, what we want to do is keep an eye on its autonomy. We want to keep an eye on, when does it not need us anymore? You know, in what regards does it not need us? What's it doing without us, right? What directions is it beginning to take without us? And that may all be a long way off, and it may never come. We may find that in the end, artificial intelligence ends up being something that supplants, supplements our own intelligence, you know, that we incorporate it into ourselves, and ultimately we become the artificial intelligences. It may never be a separate thing in that sense. It may always be a tool, may always be something we collaborate with. We don't know. There's definitely these scenarios where it goes off and has a life of its own, and we got to be very careful about that. And we've got to keep an eye on that. So I think if we're going to worry wisely about AI, that's the thing to watch out for. When does it stop being a tool and start being its own thing? And when it starts being its own thing, right, what thing is it being? Because if it's just being another person who's a friendly person, great, right? You know, world needs as many friendly people as it can get. But if it's being a person who's not friendly, or if it's being an entity that's nothing like a person, that is doing very bizarre and dangerous things, then we have to be concerned about that too. So, I think your collaboration point really drives it home. This is what technology is great for. It's great for empowering us, for bringing us together. As long as AI is doing that, fantastic. We got to keep an eye on it not doing that. keep an eye on it.
To hammer this home, Phil, and give our audience something positive to think about. You know, put the worries aside for just a second, and think about what they're doing with Watson now. Okay, Watson, of course, is IBM's computer system. It's an AI that famously dominated on Jeopardy, right?
Yep.
It's been, so to speak, going to med school ever since, and it is now being brought out to practice medicine, okay, in a sense. In 14 hospitals in U.S. and Canada, these hospital chains, by the way, Bill, are paying an undisclosed subscription amount. I'm interested in what that undisclosed subscription amount is, but we don't know.
Yep.
And so what does Watson do? Watson takes the data that is generated, and it is a ton of data, okay, that we have.
Mm-hmm.
It's 100 gigabytes of data in a single patient's genome. And so you take that data, and I presume you would also take the data of the genome of the cancer, which is totally different. It's the reason it's cancer, right? It's following a different program. And it matches up what is the very best medicine for that, initially with medicine that we actually have. And maybe someday it might just engineer a molecule that would specifically attack a specific cancer within a specific person. This cannot be done by human beings. It's just,
right.
It's beyond, you could spend a lifetime working out, you know, long after the person's died of cancer, you could spend a lifetime working on how you cure a single person and not get it done. But with machines working with doctors again, you can get there. And so this is encouraging. This is the sort of thing we want to see. But it's kind of almost ominous way IBM talks about it. If you allow me, Phil, I'm going to read the last couple of paragraphs here. Let's see here. IBM is convinced that Watson will help change the face of, but it even has bigger ambitions for the cognitive computing program. Okay, bigger than changing the face of healthcare. Okay, how can it be bigger than that? Here's speaking at an IBM event this week, the firm's chief executive made a bold prediction saying, in the future, every decision mankind makes, every decision, is going to be informed by a cognitive system like Watson, and as a result, our lives in this world are going to be better for it. End quote. Okay, so how do we worry properly? I think a fantastic golden age is within our grasp. Phil, this is the sort of thing that could bring it, but the right way to worry about it is to make sure that, again, actual people are in the loop, and it's not just, you know, we're turning over our welfare to these digital demigods. Okay, we need to be able to still call the shots in our own lives, or it's not our own lives anymore. And
right,
so that's,
right.
I think that's the right way to worry about this.
Well, there needs to be an actual, we need to be the first in the loop where that one's concerned, right? Because it's, when you're talking about your health care, right, or decisions about your own destiny, right?
Right.
You need to have a say, ultimately. That's the bottom. Because it could end up, we could end up in a world where it just makes more sense to let the machines run things, you know, because they're better than us.
Yeah.
We really could finally make that determination that we're, you know, fewer people will die, and it's like the driverless cars, right? There's aspects of that where we're taking people out of the loop because more people will live if we take people out of certain decisions and out of certain and out of certain tasks. But the big decisions about who you are and what your life is, and just, you know, having determination as to what those things are going to be, you got to keep that. If we lose that, then we've lost everything. That's the way to worry, right? I mean, the wise way to worry is to think about, well, okay, at every transaction, every wonderful gain we make, to always say, what am I losing, right? What am I giving up? We know, driverless cars is a good example, because we know it's fun to drive cars, right? I mean,
yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a kick and you feel powerful. And I mean, there's a lot to be said for driving cars. And if a driverless car takes over, you have to acknowledge, okay, well, this is going to be better in many ways and it's going to be safer, but I've given this thing up, right?
Yeah.
For every step we take in that direction, you know, when Dr. Watson is, you know, counseling us to do this or you know, recommending that course of treatment or helping us this way or whatever, you know, any of the scenarios encompassed by that wonderful quote that you just read, we always have to ask ourselves that question. What are we giving
up,
and is it too much?
That's right. I mean, so, you know, I'm thinking of the driverless cars, you know, I think of all the young people especially that have been killed in terrible automobile accidents, you know, because,
mm-hmm.
You know, it is a powerful feeling to get in a car and drive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's you know, what's more fun than that? Well, you know, not dying in a terrible crash is a lot of fun. And
being alive is more fun than that. Absolutely. It
that's right. So
you don't
appreciate, you know,
that. I mean, that's the whole problem about, you know, discounting the future and not grasping it. But living a decade is way more fun than that, ultimately. You know,
that's right.
You're doing it wrong.
And as you know, an 18-year-old whose car says, you know what, I'm not going to let you drive. You're not mature enough. You get to sit back and enjoy the ride. You know, an 18-year-old might not appreciate that. A 30-year-old certainly wouldn't appreciate that, right, Phil? I mean, the car is so much a better driver than even a, you know, fully mature and then, you know, fully sober, not tired, not emotional human being. Still much better, and therefore, you know, maybe we as a society. Now, it needs to be as a society we decide this, not the machines, decide
right.
That maybe it would be better if we just, except for on a few closed tracks for purposes of people who like to, you know, drive for sport,
yep.
You know, the rest of the driving should be handled by machine. I think that is is something that we will look at in the future, and I think ultimately the machines will win on that.
Yeah.
It's. I think that ultimately we will give that up, but it'll be after hopefully we've weighed, you know, like you say, what do we gain, what do we lose, and we decide to go with what we, you know.
Well, the other
thing
is, I mean, you know, the thing that offsets that is the subjective experience of driving will be available because we'll have really awesome virtual reality by then, and you know, I mean, you look at the driving games we have now. These will be, you know, those are nothing compared
those
to what
be, we'll have. Those will be.
You will literally.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. Those are what we have now. It will be like, you know, like toys compared to the VR
exactly.
That we'll have in a few
yeah.
years. So.
Yeah. So you know, there's a lot to be gained there, and I think there's rational exchanges to be made. We'll just have to be careful. We have to be careful about what we're giving up at every stage. Okay, I feel better. I feel like I've got a path going forward to how to worry about artificial intelligence like a wise person. We have other topics this evening that aren't necessarily things to worry about. In fact, some of them sound like pretty good news. Tell us, Stephen, about Tesla's home battery business. Going viral. What's this about a home battery business? Did he launch this in his garage?
No.
Elon Musk,
talking
that is.
About batteries for homes. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay, this is...
And that subject definitely has gone viral. I've seen it everywhere, right? Everyone's talking
yeah.
about this, aren't they?
And here's the deal. He's got enough orders. Now, again, he made his gigafactory for batteries, right? With the idea, I'm going to make batteries to put in Tesla cars and you know, I'm going to sell a bunch of cars, right? That was when the accountants were putting pencil to paper. That's what they were figuring up, right? And
yep.
So he makes the world's biggest you know, battery factory for that purpose. Well, he's got enough orders, homes, Phil, to right now the orders that he's got, he could work for two or three years with a Gigafactory and not fulfill the orders for homes and never put a battery in a car.
Right.
That is the market. That is the market that exists right now for batteries. And why do people need batteries for homes? We're talking about people that have solar panels on their homes and want to store power so they can use that when the sun goes down or when it's cloudy or whatever. That's what we're talking about there. And he's got enough orders for that he wouldn't have to, he's not even putting batteries in cars anymore. And so obviously that shows that there's a huge industry that, is completely untapped that, I suspect he'll have some competitors soon and other gigafactories will start popping up. And apparently we need it. So
this is a huge enabling technology for solar, isn't it? We've talked about the solar singularity and the price of photovoltaics going down and the efficiency of photovoltaics increasing and the fact that you're getting closer and closer to parity for how much a kilowatt costs for petroleum versus solar. But the big sticking point with solar has always been, but the sun doesn't always shine, right? I mean, that's the problem. It's
right.
Like you've got
the wind doesn't
like
always
wind.
Blow.
The wind doesn't always blow. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you've got these highly variable sources of power, but you've got a home that needs power all the time. So either you've got to stay on the grid and you've got to be reliant on another source of energy, or you need some way of storing that power. So even as solar technology is getting better and better, now we see something coming in alongside it that I think is going to be game-changing in terms of really making a push towards people using solar. People using solar in a much more serious way than they have up to this point. I think it's the response that he's getting is almost as exciting as the technology, right? Because it just shows you that this is actually occurring. That people really are making this move now, aren't they?
Yeah, 38,000 pre-orders.
Wow.
Crazy off the hook is what he calls it, and saying we can't keep up with this, and we're sold out through the middle of next year. That's always a worry, I suppose, if you're building a factory of any sort. That I'll build the factory, and I will build it, and they won't come.
Right.
But he doesn't have that issue. In fact, I suspect either he or other companies are going to start looking at this industry and saying, maybe the world needs more of these factories producing these batteries. So, it's exciting. It's exciting that I suspect it'll be one of those things, Phil. We haven't had any. These technologies will drive each other. We have not had batteries sufficient to do what needed to be done before, and so now that it looks like we will, then that not only is going to drive the production of more batteries, which is a good thing for cars or whatever, but also it will drive solar. So all of a sudden, I can be on solar power, 24/7. Yeah, you can with these battery packs. Well, cool. I'm buying solar now, and so and of course, the more people that buy it, and the more R&D goes into it, and it's you're in a virtuous cycle at that point.
Absolutely, the technology just keeps getting better.
And which makes the battery technology better, which encourages the solar, and it just goes round and round, and it's exciting.
Absolutely is. It's going to be really interesting to see this this solar singularity that we've been predicting, or that we've been repeating Ray Kurzweil's prediction of, to be more precise, for the last few years. Watching this unfold, and when you see something like this, you go, "Yep, this is happening. This really is happening." And 20 years
from now, we'll start seeing it in The Economist. It'll be in The Economist.
Exactly. Yeah, they're going to be talking about The Economist, not as a technology issue, but as an economic issue, right? I mean, they'll be talking about it as the impact it's having on the economy. 20 years from now, when the whole conversation about energy is 100% different than it, well, not 100%, but completely different than it is today. When the assumptions are different, the expectations are different, and just our, you know, just our attitude, our outlook on you know, what we can expect in terms of having energy is so completely different from what we expect or demand or think is going to happen today. It'll be hard to remember that it used to be like this. you know what I'm saying? It's like, we'll go, oh, yeah, I remember it was a big deal when suddenly you get a battery and then solar really started to work. And, you know, we'll remember a time when, you know, for those of us who don't, because I never have had, we'll remember a time when we didn't have solar panels on our homes and think, how strange was it that all that power was there and we weren't using it and we were using these other sources, which will still be around and still be used, but this shift from everything else really to solar, I think, is going to be really hard to get your head around. It's going to be a very different world, and we're seeing the beginning of it now.
I think it'll be a more secure world in a number of ways, Bill, because you know, when you have decentralized power, there's not a target to be struck by, you know, whoever wants to do us harm. You know, if everyone's producing their own power, you know, you can't knock out you can't knock the grid down. It's not as
right.
easily anyway. And so if you managed to, you wouldn't do as much harm. And so that's important too.
Well, one of the really interesting things I remember from Bob Zubrin's book, Energy Victory, in which he was making the case for, methanol fuel, but talking about kind of the history of energy in the 20th century is the really close relationship between what was going on in all the wars and who had the oil. You know, there's a lot more to that than you realize. Not to say World War II or World War I or Korea or Vietnam were over oil. They weren't. They were over other things. They were over other geopolitical concerns. But it factored huge into all of those things, and it has been a big driving factor in so much of what goes on between countries, so much of what goes on that's not very good. You know, the power dynamics around it have been a destabilizing factor, and they've been a source of contention, a source of greed and of envy, and just, you know, all the things you don't want going on between nations if you want a peaceful world. And yeah, everybody starts growing their own, and, you know, for better or for worse, that has to diminish. You know, when the oil is less important, which it is bound to become.
That's a good thing for the world. It really is, because and it's a good thing for even the oil producing countries ultimately.
Yep.
And here's you're thinking, well, how could that be? Life in most oil producing, oil rich nations is not that great for the average person. You end up with an elite at the top that gets the benefit of the wealth, and the rest, and, you know, and they don't have to invest in their population. You know, you don't have to educate your people. You don't have to, you know, get really good at some particular industry or another. You just pull the oil out of the ground and sell it to the world. That's you know, that's not a recipe for happiness for the people that have to live there. And so, you know, if we can defund that, that's a good thing.
I think
and
so too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So.
And just more power for everybody. And oil will still be used. There just won't be the urgency around it anymore. You know, it's like, oh, if you can't get oil, you know, one of the things I think we even talked about this when we had him on the show all those years ago was in World War II, when things got really desperate and the Germans figured out how to make fuel out of, they made liquid fuel out of coal, right? Because
right.
it was like
right.
they weren't going to be able to keep going because they couldn't pump oil anymore. But I mean, that's what it always comes down to, is this desperation of, if you run out of oil, you're done, right? Once the oil's
right.
gone, you're done. And in the world, the future we're moving into, it's like, well, if you run out of oil, it might be really inconvenient, but you're not done anymore, you know.
Yeah.
There's just other options, and it creates more security any way you look at it. So there's a thing to lessen your worries right there. Tesla's batteries. If you're worried about the future, just think about all the wonderful things these batteries are telling you. If you'll only let them.
Mention another worry that Elon Musk has. You know, we've mentioned in the show already. One of his worries is we have all our eggs in one basket, that being the planet Earth, and he wants to, you know, have a colony on Mars, right? That's part of his deal, and so that's part of the push behind SpaceX. We've been following for a little while the Impossible Drive that NASA's been working on, and that. Wouldn't that be awesome, Phil, if we were not talking rocketry anymore between our planet and Mars? We were, we had a drive that didn't require the use of any propellant, and that's what the Impossible Drive is about. And so, one of the things I think we mentioned maybe even last week was that just very recently they were able to do some tests in an actual vacuum. You see, they thought that the drive, what they were measuring as far as the push the drive was putting out, could have been an artifact of the fact that it's, you know, there's an atmosphere around it, okay?
Right.
And so they removed the atmosphere and tried it again, and hey, we're still getting a push, and they don't quite understand, you know, what, you know, classical. Physics doesn't really explain it. It's some sort of quantum weirdness going on here, because you know normally in order to get any kind of push, you have to expel something, you have to put out some sort of propellant. But that's not what's happening here. And
it's just bizarre.
It's a strange thing.
You hear it, you go, so we don't know how it works, but we know it works. Assuming it does pan out, assuming it delivers, I think, you know, going back to your earlier point, that after the space elevator, this will be the number two huge technology for really getting us out into space. I think there are probably three big technologies that are going to play a huge role, and one of them is robotics. The other one is the space elevator, and the third one is something like this, because you can really do long-term, moving around the solar system with a craft like that, that's powered with something like that. You don't have to be constantly putting yourself in orbit. You just fly from, you know, one place to another, like they do in Star Trek, right? And potentially, when you start thinking in terms of longer space voyages, when you start thinking in terms of interstellar travel, it's got to be something like this, right? There's no way you're ever going to go beyond the solar system using, fossil fuels. You know, it's not going to happen.
You can't back enough. You just can't back enough.
There's got to be something. There's got to be something like this that will work. And that's where the battery technology probably is going to factor huge too. You know, I mean, we're talking about many, many generations down the road. But I agree. It's an enabling technology to us really taking a step out, you know, getting our eggs out of just this one basket and spreading out into the solar system. The other big enabler for that is all this talk now of mining the asteroids. That's not a technology. That's a motivation, right? But the great thing is when you start to see these things converging, you know, as a lawyer, Stephen, I'm sure you're familiar with the means, motive, and opportunity.
You have to have a reason to do something, or it just won't get done.
It's like all these things are coming into place. We're developing the technology, we're developing the capability to do things, and a reason to go. I think Elon Musk is correct that having humanity survive should, God forbid, you know, something cataclysmic happened to the Earth is a good enough reason. But it's not going to be a good enough reason for individuals. I mean, that's a good reason for anybody to say, yeah, that's why we should have somebody else out there. But you want a reason for somebody to go, this is why I need to get out into space, right? I mean, when people start saying that.
I want to make money whatever. There's got to be some reason.
Yeah, I want to go have an adventure. I want to make some money. I want to go discover the new frontier, whatever it is that motivates them. But when those kinds of incentives are offered, that's going to be the kind of thing that really starts moving people in that direction. And there you go. That's one, you know, one other thing. You can worry constructively about this, right? You know, not worry so much that none of these things are going to happen, but, you know, is enough being done, and are we on the right timetable, and how do we move this along? But it's very encouraging to see these kinds of steps. And does anybody have any idea, any, like, there must be a hypothesis as to how it actually does work?
Yeah, and again, I think it comes down to something happening on the quantum level, and it doesn't really break the laws of classical physics. I think it's operating on a different level. You know, and so maybe it's doing something with space. Maybe it's a slight warping of space or something like that that's happening there. If you can, if you are bunching up space behind you and stretching it out in front of you, there would be a tendency to be propelled without the need of anything being pushed out, from a rocket engine or something. And so maybe something like that is happening, but they don't quite have their hand on what exactly is happening. And I think that investigating this and figuring out exactly what's happening will allow them to do it better. And so they're frantically investigating it so that they can do it. If they go, oh, that's what's happening here. Well, let's ramp that up then. Once they have a handle on the mechanism, they can exactly what's doing what is what. Then maybe they can improve on it more easily instead of accidentally. And so, that's pretty awesome. Well, Phil, we have one last topic tonight. And
we've already talked about IBM's Watson supercomputer speeding up cancer. We worked that one into the AI discussion earlier. And there was another AI topic that I didn't add to the list, but I think we can probably skip, which was the link you had sent me earlier about although it is pretty interesting, the story about China saying that their AI is now the smartest in the world. That was interesting, just for the questions that it raises when you read it. You look at it and you go, well, what do they mean? I mean, they're showing a benchmark where they say our AI can classify, what was it, 1,000 different pictures or 1,000 different picture types?
Or something like that. And it could get it right like 96% of the time or something like that. And
it was 95.42% of the time, whereas Google's system gets 95.2. So they're a whole
and Microsoft is 95.1, you know, slightly less than that. All three systems are better than human. And if there's anything we are pretty good at, Phil, as humans, and that's recognizing our friends, we can look at a human face and differentiate them pretty well. Well, these machines do it even better. And so,
the way I read this, I didn't read this as face recognition. I read this as they're giving it a lot of images and it's classifying them, right? It's saying, okay, these are all cats, right? These are all, whatever. Fences. It's a million pictures or something like that it's looking at. And it's actually creating categories and scoring things and ranking, what category a picture belongs to. You'd think that's a really simple and obvious thing because we are very good at that, right? And if you show me or you a picture of a cat and then a picture of a dog, that, you know, you can show us pictures of cats and dogs all day, and very rarely are we going to come on one where we go, well, gee, I don't know. It would be a weird, weird, weird outlying cat or dog that would right that would give us any confusion. Same with, like, you know, is it a house or a fence, right? It's you know, it's not easy for us to confuse those things. But a computer doesn't know any of this, right? It's just looking at pictures and describing
crunching
the features
data.
Of pictures. It's just saying, this is a picture that has these things in it, and defining those properties back. It is reverse engineering the process that we think of as, you know, a good deal of what goes on in our vision, which is just classifying things, you know, just seeing categories of things. You look around a room and you say, there's an envelope, there's a book, there's a telephone. You know, we think of this as all built in and innate. It's really not. It's something that that we all learned to do, but we were given the categories by other people, right? People told us what the categories are. These computers, you know, they're not given the categories. Later, you can tell them, you can give them words for the categories they figured out, but they're just, you know, classifying images. And yeah, I think it's very telling to think how good we are at it, that they're better at it than we are is pretty interesting. I think the difference between what the Chinese system is doing and the other two systems is, you know, potentially a rounding error. I don't think it's enough faster that speed tells you much of anything, because I think it's, you know, it's entirely possible that the quality of classification might actually be better amongst the Google ones or something like that. But really interesting to see multiple players making this kind of progress, and it's really coming along fast. Computers are teaching themselves how to be more like us. Should we be worried?
Quickly.
I guess that's the question. Huh? Yeah.
Yeah. Quickly. Okay. Well, we had one last story, and I thought that this one was interesting, Bill. It's cars without windows. Okay. So
yes.
And you know, the story gets into why we wouldn't, and that is what I found fascinating. You know, I'm thinking to myself, what would be worse than being in a automobile without windows? Even if the car's doing the driving for me, I want to look outside and watch, you know, watch what's going on down the road. Well, the thing that you know, the article pointed out is that windows are, you know, there's a lot of bad things about windows,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the main thing is safety. You know, you get no protection. That area of your car is the least protected area in the event of a crash. And if you didn't have to worry about that, if it was, you know, you got into a solid piece of metal with no glass anywhere in it, how much safer that would be. How much cooler that would be in the summertime when you don't have light heating up the cabin. How much warmer it'd be in the winter, because, you know, you lose a lot of heat through the glass. It was basically it said, you know, here's what, you know, again, it's a measuring of what do we give up and what do we gain. If we were to have a system that had photorealistic views of the outside, if that's what we wanted to see, or, you know, or the internet or anything else. Oh, one last thing that you give up with glass, privacy. Anybody that, as you're driving down the road, everybody can see you just like you can see everybody else. So, if you gave up glass, then you would gain in all of those areas, and you wouldn't potentially lose too much if you had photorealistic displays allowing you to see the world outside as you are driven by your auto drive car, right? So I thought that was a interesting article. I had never even considered, you know, the first cars that drive you will obviously still have glass in them. We won't give up glass as the first thing that we do when we have cars that drive us, but, you know, two or three generations into it, I could see, yeah, definitely giving that up and gaining a lot and losing very little.
You know, what I think the analogy is, The analogy is the first hard top. People thought it was the end of the world when they put a hard top on a car for the first time. And this is, you know, 100 years ago or more probably when they first started doing that. Because it was just like the buggy before. You know, you want the open air. Why are you going outside if you're not even gonna have the open air? Of course, you want the option always of taking the of there not being anything over your head when you're out in a car. Well, most of us have never even had a convertible. I mean, most people don't drive them, and you know, there's a certain mystique to them or whatever. But I think that cars with windows will be kind of like convertibles.
If you've ever had them built, they're a bit of a pain in the butt, though. Just when.
So I hear.
Yeah.
Well, there's. I mean, there's the rain thing, if nothing else. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. Once you see the advantage, right, and once you get inside a space that has the display you're talking about, and you get used to that idea, and you get used to the privacy, I think the trade-off is probably ultimately going to be worth it, and people probably will go in that direction, although it sounds strange to us now. It really is, you know, the idea of being in a totally enclosed car without windows doesn't sound as much fun as having windows, but, you know, I agree with you. I think in the long run, if they're going to be fully autonomous vehicles, they'll be a lot safer that way, and we won't lose anything in the process.
Yep. And it will be interesting to see. I don't think that that would be right around the corner. I'd say this would be two or three generations into the auto drive cars before we begin to see that being offered. But yeah,
and where I would end it is to say, I'm sure windows will still be an option, so don't worry. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So, lastly, don't worry.
you can ease your mind on that one. Absolutely. All right, Steve. Well, we got through all of our topics. I think that means that it's time to ask, what is the music tonight? I don't think it's going to be the Salt and Pepper piece we talked about earlier.
No, it's not.
Sadly,
the music tonight is Silence by Telephantom, and I don't want you to worry, Phil. It's not 3 minutes and 46 seconds of nothing. It's an actual song here called Silence. So,
all right,
anyway.
Telephantom singing Silence. Thank you, Stephen, for finding that for us. Thanks for all the great topics tonight too. Thank you all for being with us. We will be back again next week with an all new show. And until next time, live to see it.